Divide it, we fall is the motto of this year's Warsaw Security Forum, where we're doing a special episode of DW Berlin Briefing podcast. And with me here in the studio is Michael Carpenter, who's a senior fellow with the Institute for Strategic Studies. Thank you very much for making the time. And Hanno Pevkur, who's Estonia's defense minister. Everybody's talking about Estonia here at this forum. I'm very looking forward to hearing your thoughts about what's going on in terms of airspace violations, and but also in terms of what NATO's response should be when it comes to how to end the war in Ukraine. And of course, we've got Richard Walker here. Richard is a very familiar face to everybody who's been following the podcast. So maybe, Mike, can we start with you? Jens Stoltenberg, NATO's Secretary General for 10 years, here at the forum, said that one of his big regrets was that NATO allies didn't show more resolve when it came to reacting to the invasion of Crimea in 2014, that maybe even Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine could have been prevented if NATO allies had sent more arms to Ukraine. You were also a foreign policy advisor in the Biden administration. Were you too hesitant?
Well, you're talking about the period from 2014 until the full-scale invasion. So that was mostly the Obama administration and then the first Trump administration as well. Absolutely, the United States was far too timid. That was the time when we should have put in deterrence capabilities into Ukraine. To his credit, President Trump in the first term gave Ukraine the Javelin shoulder-fired anti-tank missiles, which then during the assault on Kyiv actually proved incredibly important in repelling some of the armor that was coming in, but it wasn't sufficient to deter. To deter, Ukraine should have had ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, more air power, and a range of other capabilities that they didn't have because nobody wanted to provoke Russia at the time. So Secretary General Stoltenberg is absolutely right, but it was a collective failure. I mean, don't put this all on the United States. I always say to countries that criticize the United States first and foremost, you know, you're part of the reaction that you're seeing from President Trump now. Because when you say that U.S. should solve all your problems, you know, have a little introspection on what other countries, including European ones, could have done at the same time.
European countries were very hesitant, Hanno Pevkur. That leads me to you. Estonia was not one of them. But, for example, countries like Germany, the defense minister, Boris Pistorius, said again here at this forum, because he was here as well, that many countries woke up after Crimea, but Germany, like others, just press the snooze button again. So is that something that people should still be talking about, or do we have more pressing topics? And do you think we need to talk about reactions now and what can be done, and what was in the past should remain in the past?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting, but we cannot change the past. We can change the future, and we can learn from the past. And definitely we have to learn from the past. And yes, indeed, you know, Mike mentioned the javelins. Yes, Estonia sent before the full-scale invasion the javelins to Ukraine, to Kyiv. And, you know, I've heard that so many times in Kyiv that these javelins helped to avoid collapse of Kyiv. And, you know, this blitzkrieg what Putin started, you know, to take Kyiv in 3 days. So, yes, we started from the very beginning helping Ukraine. Did we do enough? Well, you know, I believe, yes, collectively, we didn't give enough, especially in 2022. When you remember, there was a counteroffensive move on Kharkiv, and Ukrainians were extremely successful there. The problem for them was that they didn't have enough firepower and they didn't have enough equipment to move even further. And the consequence of that is that Russians have built now huge fortifications, and for both, and also Ukrainians. So for both sides, it is extremely difficult to go now and take back very quickly the territories which were available to take on 22. So in that sense, I've said that in last years many times that we have to decide whether we want Ukraine to win or to fight. And then so far we have only given the means to fight, but not to win. So, and even today, you know, when many stocks are empty and and we cannot give more much from our own stocks. Everyone can give more money, and Ukrainian industry is capable of producing twice as much they are doing today. So they produce today in worth of 16, 17 billions. Their capacity is to produce for 34, 35 billions. So and when nobody is or has nothing to give the money. It's so simple. And that gives, and this is why we came out with 0.25% initiative from GDP. And we are giving that and have been giving that and much more each year. But even giving 0.25 each year would have given to Ukraine around 100 to 120 billion annually. But we have given this 100 billion in all 3.5 years. So this shows that we have given only like 0.1% of our GDP. So 99.9% are still in our own countries, and not considering the growth of economy. So we have not done enough, but still there is a possibility to give the momentum, because at the moment there is no fight about who's getting what back. Is it 10 kilometers here or 10 kilometers there? The fight goes on at the moment for better negotiation position. And this is what we have to give to Ukraine.
Yeah, so I mean, you do have this impression that the war does feel pretty stuck, yeah? So the Russians have been on the offensive this year, but their progress is kind of ground down. So we're back into this kind of discussions about, you know, some of the things you're just talking about have been discussions over the last couple of years, really, haven't they? But you sense from a lot of the political leaders here that they're trying to push back against this sense of fatigue in their public, so they just can't really be bothered with this anymore. But at the same time, this feeling that, oh, well, the war is getting closer. You feel it in Estonia. You feel it here in Poland with the incursions that have been going on. I mean, I'd love to hear from both of you on this. But, of course, Estonia, you know, hit by, you know, one of the gravest of these incursions, these Russian fighter jets flying for 12 minutes through your airspace, ignoring requests by scrambled fighters to leave the airspace. Do you feel happy in Estonia, as a country that is totally dependent on NATO for support in situations like that, with the NATO response so far? Or would you be one of the voices that have been saying, well, that there have been some question marks raised about the response?
So maybe I'll start and then give over to Mike. So regarding that airspace violation, first, NATO reacted and responded very properly. Let's be clear, because I hear here and there that somebody is saying that why didn't you shoot these airplanes down and look what Turkey did, you know, shooting down. So, but this is not comparable, because Russian fighter jets and bombers bombed Syrian villages with ethnic Turks, and it was totally different situation. So basically there was a war situation which we didn't have. Secondly, NATO aircrafts, two Finnish aircrafts, two Italian and two Swedish. There was a clear superiority in the sky that old junkyard MiGs, more than 40 years old, flying there against fifth generation F-35s and Gripens. So they had no chance, and there was no real, acute threat to our sovereignty, or risk that they will attack us with the weapon systems. So when somebody is saying that, let's shoot them down immediately, and we have enough cowboys around the world who would like to shoot them down. But when you say A, you need to say also B, and you have, or at least you have to be ready for B and second A. So this is why we are assessing every situation. Every operation is different. Also in last couple of months, Italians have scrambled 7 times Russian aircrafts. So this is, you know, a normal thing for us in a way, but of course was not normal that they came into our space for 12 minutes. So this is why we started Article 4 consultations. This is why we raised this topic in UN Security Council. And this is why also we saw that Italians said immediately that we will keep the SAMT long-range air defense in Estonia. And you know, this was the proper response. This is first. Secondly, when we talk about the Russians and their behavior, So basically, this is exactly what they want to see, that we are talking here, and all the societies are talking that should we, you know, or this is this a provocation, or that we are playing the chess game what Russians are putting to the table. Instead of that, we should say that whatever you do, don't worry, we will respond if necessary, and we will continue with the military assistance to Ukraine. Because when we start playing the chess game what Russia is putting us to play, then we've lost in a way in strategic communication immediately. Mm. So this is why my advice is that we will react as we need, but let's talk about that, how we can pressure Russia with sanctions. They don't want to see the sanctions, but let's talk about the sanctions. Let's talk about, you know, helping Ukraine more, and let's squeeze the Russian economy so that they will be on their knees and coming to the Ukrainians and asking for peace negotiations.
Yeah, and Michael, maybe to pick up on one of the specifics there. So this kind of range of responses, like you say, there have been some who say, oh, we have to be ready to shoot down. And President Trump has said, yeah, okay, shoot down. Donald Tusk has said, we need to be ready to shoot down. Michael, do you think that's the right kind of talk to have? Or while others are saying, oh, no, we kind of need to kind of be relatively calm. Is that loose talk? Is that kind of being cowboy, or how would you be playing it? You were in the National Security Council a year ago. What would you be advising?
Hi, I'm Kate Laycock, host of DW's weekly European Current Affairs programme, Inside Europe. Our correspondents were there when the Berlin Wall fell, when the Balkans Wars broke out, and when Britain voted to leave the European Union. Now the continent is changing again, and we're rising to the challenge, bringing you a combination of expert analysis and on-the-ground reporting. Join us every Thursday.
We're having a very tactical discussion around rules of engagement, right? And of course NATO is going to have to come up with rules of engagement. They exist to a large degree. But they should be crystal clear so that the Russians also know that if they pose a threat, that NATO will be prepared to act. But let's step back from the tactical and talk about the strategic. What Putin is doing, the Estonians know this better than, you know, any other country. But what Putin is doing is he's sort of sending a wake-up call as well to those further to the West. You know, Russia is engaging in a war against Western countries. And it has been for a long time. I gave a speech at the National Security Agency in 2016. Basically, the title of that speech was Russia's Covert War Against the West. It's often in the shadows, but it goes back, you know, you could say to Putin's speech at the Munich Security Conference in 2007, or you could date it to the Russia-Georgia War of 2008. But in any case, it is a war that is being waged sometimes through political means, sometimes through information or cognitive warfare, sometimes through drones to test, sometimes through sabotage operations, an attempt to assassinate a CEO of a major German company. There's various different permutations to this war, but the bottom line is it is aggressive, it is hostile, and it is confrontational, sometimes kinetic. And so we have to wrap around the totality of this and not focus on the rules of engagement for a pilot who is intercepting a Russian MiG over NATO airspace. That's important. I'm not saying it's not important, but let's look at the broad totality of this. And yeah, you know, Ahana is absolutely right. We need to have a much more concerted policy vis-a-vis Russia. What concerns me is that at the NATO 75th anniversary summit in Washington, the alliance tasked that NATO would develop a strategy on Russia. And it walked away from that tasking. Why? Because there was no consensus within the alliance on how to confront Russia. And as a result, you had a summit in The Hague where we talked a lot of happy talk, right? And I give Mark Rutte some credit for the strategic communications. But a lot of happy talk about spending a percentage of GDP on defense, but not so much on the strategic threat, which is Russia, and what we do about it. So that's actually where the conversation should be taking place.
And just maybe we need to move on from this in a moment, but I'm just curious, I've been asking a lot of people here this question, and I'm curious what you guys think. Do you think Putin is trying to provoke a crisis with this? He's trying to provoke an incident that could go out of control to some extent, where he feels that he's in a stronger position to manage such an unstable situation than the West, thinking that might help to break NATO unity.
start?
No, you go ahead.
Okay.
You start.
I share with Mike. We share the mic. Well, this is exactly what I was talking to, that Russia wants us to play their cards. And strategically, we should understand and to react vice versa. So we have to do what we need to do. I would just remember all of us, early 80s and even late 70s. So Russia started to develop the S-300 air defense systems because they believed that NATO, and specifically the United States, is ready to launch a missile attack on Moscow. So they need, or they were afraid that maybe the West will attack them. Now we are talking here that, you know, we have to build up the air defense systems and Iron Dome or Golden Dome, whatever, because we believe that, you know, Russia is a threat to us. Yes, Russia is a threat, but we can also turn this around and to talk about more offensive capabilities and what we have. Because this is part of the narrative and part of the deterrence, that you have to show that you have the capabilities to not only to defend your country, but also make harm to your adversaries. So, but, you know, Putin provocations have been in, why I mentioned 2007, it's not only the speech of Munich, but it's the first full-scale state-orchestrated hybrid attack against neighbor. So when Russia attacked Estonia in the cyber field. So this marks basically the day when Russia started to conduct state orchestrated operations, hybrid warfare against the West. After that, you've seen assassinations, you mentioned, you know, hybrid, and also interference to the elections. This is all part of that. We've just not seen the kinetic warfare, but assassinations, hybrid attacks, critical infrastructure underwater. So this is all part of that, you know, that they are scratching the surface all the time and then trying to see where is the threshold of Article 5 and what are our counter moves, what we do, what are our actions, and also to see, you know, when we bring up the AUX, what are the routes, you know, to gather intelligence. So this is why it's not the game only that three MiGs are flying somewhere. It's much broader game, which we need to play smartly. So this is why I fully agree with Mike that we need to have this strategic concept, what we have towards Russia.
Of course, can I just ask again, because I think what Richard just referred to was also a scenario where the Russian population doesn't get to see any of the footage of Russian incursions, operations, whatever you want to call them, in NATO airspace, for example. So, you know, is that a scenario where in Russia nobody's aware and then NATO brings down a plane and then Russia can say, look, they started it, and they can mobilize more people than they can at the moment when people are beginning to say, okay, well, this war has been going on for a very long time, it's very, very expensive, etc. Michael, can we get your reaction to that?
Yeah, but so to a degree, yes, but Russia understands that it is vastly inferior in terms of conventional capabilities with respect to NATO. So Russia is going to always try to keep it below the Article 5 kinetic cap. I mean, they want to, the gray zone warfare, you know, irregular, unconventional warfare, whatever you want to call it, it's warfare, right? But it's deliberately kept below that threshold because the Russians know that they can't go head to head with NATO or the United States. So, and it's also cheaper. It's cheaper and arguably it's more effective. And this is the key point. If it's, you know, if Russia is able to conduct information operations, or what we call cognitive warfare, use dark money to channel it to a political party in a Western country that then gets that country to start to be more aligned with Russia. That's success. That's success that they could never achieve, probably not even if the war in Ukraine lasted for 10 years. Well, actually, it's been going on for 10 years since 2014, but another 10 years, they couldn't achieve that success on the battlefield. So this is where NATO, the EU, and all the countries individually in the West, collectively, need to step up their game and punch back, because these are little pinpricks, but we treat them individually, right? We don't aggregate the totality of what Russia's doing against our societies and then hit back en masse as a collective. We don't do that. We respond to the pinpricks, and that's less effective, because then, you know, Russia decides, I can bear that cost and I can continue to go with this line of attack, if you will.
But one requirement would be for all Europeans to agree, one, that this is what is required in terms of common strategy, and two, you know, democracies have their challenges, right? There's always elections. These messages are not very popular with a lot of the European population, so people tone it down a little when they are in campaign
races,
etc.
Well, can I just on this? Yes, absolutely. Your former colleague Gabriela Landsbergis has done a really great piece on this. Too many Western leaders are not telling the truth, not you, but others, to their publics about this, because seriously, the message has come across as we've got everything under control, European publics have nothing to worry about, which by and large is true, but if we don't talk about the nature of the threat, then how can we consider policies such as spending 3.5% of GDP on defense when a lot of publics are, you know, reluctant to embrace that kind of a target? Or to embrace, say, mobilization or conscription for an entire population. That's a difficult political step to take. But if you don't explain the threat, then how are you going to ever sell that policy to your public? So Western politicians, again, Baltics and Poland are probably accepted from this, need to speak a little bit more candidly about what's going on out there.
But Donald Tusk, I mean, Polish Prime Minister, he said here at this forum, this is our war. And this is not something that you would hear from leaders of countries that are further west. The further west you go, the easier it becomes to forget about the situation on the ground in Ukraine. How relieved were you to hear Poland's Prime Minister talk like this here?
Well, I believe that, you know, as Mike said, that we do not have like misunderstanding or miscalculation regarding Russia in the Baltics and or here in Poland. One thing we really have to understand is that, you know, this, what we do today, affects also what we see tomorrow. And a lot has been discussions about the security guarantees for Ukraine. I would rephrase that. It's not security guarantees from Europe to Ukraine. At the moment, we see security guarantees from Ukraine to Europe. And every additional asset, equipment we send to Ukraine, this is a security guarantee for Europe. Because I've said that so many times, that the Baltic frontier is the front door of NATO, and we need to keep that front door closed. Because when the front door is closed, then, you know, the doors inside of the room or inside of the house can be open. You know, we can freely move. We have, all the freedoms here. And we don't have to control that, because we are keeping the doors closed. So Ukraine is keeping the door closed at the moment in Ukraine for the Russians. Does that mean that Russians don't want to move further? No, because we see that all the time. They try to change the election result in Moldova. They've been quite successful in some European countries with political campaigns. And this is what they do. So this is why, you know, once again, the proper answer to all these questions you also raise is actually, you know, helping Ukraine to win the war, and then to go there to reconstitute their Ukrainian army. And, you know, everyone who has any doubts in the Western societies or everywhere, I, you know, like to raise just one question. And this question is quite simple. So when we have a choice, do we want to have 1 million trained, equipped, and the battlefield-proven soldiers on our side or on the Russian side, when I talk about Ukrainian army? And I have only one answer to that. So I want to have Ukrainians on our side. They want to be on our side. So why we are not doing that enough to give them the chance to be on our side? So So this is why, you know, that we maybe need to rephrase also the question of the security guarantees for Ukraine.
I mean, Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, addressed this conference, of course, by video link at the outset. And he had one particular proposal that kind of, you know, ties in a bit to what you're talking about linking European and Ukrainian security, and referring to these drones that came across and saying, look, let's work together on taking out those drones while they're still in Ukrainian airspace. What are your responses to that? The idea that NATO countries actually start to partner with Ukrainians more in active defense over Ukrainian skies?
Very briefly about that, and Mike can add, but we are doing that today. We've been sending a lot of equipment, so radars, Gepard air defense systems, from the shore out until the ballistic air defense Patriots. So we are doing that already today. So we are securing the Ukrainian skies just with the fingers and, you know, pushing the buttons from Ukrainians. But the Europeans are securing the Ukrainian skies. President Zelensky mentioned the other thing. He mentioned that Ukraine can help Europeans to secure the European skies. And this is where I say very clearly that, you know, every experience we have from Ukraine, we have to bring it home. I said that already in 22, that, you know, my task is to bring every lessons learned in Ukraine back home and to build our resilience based on the Ukrainian experience. So, yes, we need to do that. And of course, at the moment, Ukrainians have no ability or should not have any ability to come to our territory, because they need to focus defending their own country, and we need to be focusing on that, how we help them to do that.
Yeah, so I agree with everything that Hanno has said, but what I would also underscore is that, with all due respect, I think a lot of European leaders right now are focusing on the wrong thing. The UK and France in particular are hosting endless meetings of this coalition of the willing to talk about a reassurance force for Ukraine. That's a fantasy. There's not going to be a reassurance force for Ukraine for a simple reason. If that force, if European publics are not willing to deploy a force prior to a ceasefire, Putin is never going to go for a ceasefire when he knows that European boots on the ground are going to be in Ukraine. Now, people will say, well, but Putin doesn't get a veto. But yeah, he does, because he gets to decide whether there's a ceasefire or not. So why spend all these countless hours talking about a reassurance force that is frankly a little bit of magical thinking, and focus instead on the one thing that European leaders can do? Fortunately, they are starting to talk about that, and Ursula von der Leyen is the one who's leading those discussions, and that involves mobilizing the immobilized Russian assets in Western jurisdictions, which has been vetoed thus far by one particular country, Belgium, for obvious reasons, because most of these assets are located
there. Is it 80% or something?
It's something like 80%. But then also some of the larger countries as well. France has been very reluctant to move in this direction. I think von der Leyen is now starting to cohere a consensus within the EU that this needs to happen. And there's a creative formula for issuing a bond and then using that as collateral for a loan that Ukraine would only pay back if Russia then paid Ukraine reparations. The legal framework is creative. I don't know much about the specifics of it. But the point is, the money has to be mobilized for Ukraine. Forget about 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 European troops after a ceasefire. I mean, yeah, we should eventually talk about that down the road. But right now what Ukraine needs, and this is exactly to your point, what they need is they need the resources to themselves invest in their own drone production, in their own defense industrial base, so that they can take the fight to the Russians, and then we'll all be more secure as a result of that if they are successful.
Yeah, you were referring to Ursula von der Leyen's proposal, where apparently now they've found a way to make it legally possible, because that is one of those thoughts that also has kept Germany from agreeing to do more with those frozen Russian assets. But we'll have to wait for the details, of course, to come out. But Hanno, you've also suggested something else in terms of targeting Russia and Russia's income more. So, you know, include that aspect into strategic thinking.
Well, yeah, two aspects. First, regarding the sanctions and the oil price. So just to have a very short calculation. So Russia is drilling today 10 million barrels daily. So when we could lower the price of the oil globally for $1, this is 10 million less daily. Let's assume that half of that goes somewhere, somehow. So even when it's like 5 million daily, then it's in 1 month $150 million less money for the Russian war machine. You lower the price for $10, then it's $1.5 billion. So, and this is something, you know, which is very easy to calculate. The second, you know, the frozen assets. The frozen assets, you know, we collectively we have not given even close to that amount what is in frozen assets today. Yes, we've used the windfall profits. But when you take the frozen assets, everybody who's saying that, you know, oh, there might be a legal issue or something, has Russia looked ever to international law? Killing civilians, raping women and deporting children, so and bombing children hospitals and you know, everything which has no right to be bombed according to the international law. So they don't care about the international law. So, of course, that, I'm not saying that we should be the same or act the same, but my point is that when we clearly see that Russia has to pay the reparations, then we should use the frozen assets in full amount immediately. And when Russia claims then in the international court one day that they have the right to get it back or somehow, let's argue, let's dispute in the court. And then when you use the frozen assets, then this affects or impacts the oligarchs and, let's say, lower level of high-income Russians in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And when this happens, then these people will start to ask from the Kremlin, hey, this has gone too far. And then we can put the pressure to Putin to come to sit behind the table and talk.
We have talked a lot now about the need for a comprehensive strategic response by Ukraine's allies. And Mike, since you are a US citizen, I need to just end on the big elephant in the room. What is Donald Trump going to do? Because, of course, the US still features very strongly in that calculation, also by Europeans. Have we got any information on the on NATO force posture review that many people were expecting to come after the NATO summit, but we haven't heard about yet? Is the US going to withdraw troops?
Well, look, rather than try to predict the future, I mean, I think there is likely going to be a force posture reduction in Europe. We'll have to see from which countries and how deep the cuts will be. But when it comes to Ukraine, I mean, just look at the track record of the administration. I mean, they've been in office now for 9 months, right? So we don't have to guess as to what they're going to do or not do. We know the amount of assistance that has been provided to Ukraine is $0. The number of tariffs that have been levied on Russia is zero as compared to every other country in the world. The number of sanctions that the Trump administration has imposed on Russia is zero. So there's a lot of rhetoric that goes back and forth and keeps the pundits and the analysts guessing as to whether there's a U-turn or change or more seriousness of purpose with regards to Russia and empowering Ukraine. But don't look at the words, look at the deeds. The actions speak for themselves. There has been zero support thus far. Now that has galvanized European action, which is a good thing. But, you know, ideally, the United States would be part of this effort as well, because we ultimately have a stake in European security, whether we like it or not, and whether we admit it or not.
I know we have to wrap up, but just as a final question to you from Mike, from me. Obviously, yeah, lots of zeros in terms of Ukraine from the U.S. administration, but Donald Trump can fairly say that he's the guy now who really got NATO to massively increase its defense spending. The Germans have changed their constitution and they're gushing money into it. Do you look at that and think, oh God, maybe we were a little bit too friendly to Germany. Maybe we should have got a bit Trumpy on Olaf Scholz, the previous chancellor?
So first thing I'll say is, you know, President Trump is absolutely right that Europeans should be paying their share and should be paying more for security in Europe. That's a true statement. the number of countries that spent 2% of their GDP on defense went from 6 at the very beginning of the Biden administration to 22 or 23, depending on how you count, at the end. Now, I would like to give Joe Biden credit for that, but I'm not. I'm going to give the credit to Vladimir Putin, because countries react to threats. Citizens spend more of their GDP, or they're willing to elect politicians to spend more of their GDP on defense when they feel the threat. The threat is acute, and that's why Europeans are stepping up. But it takes leadership to galvanize the alliance to be able to do the right things. And right now we've got a pledge, which is great. 3.5%, 5% if you count resilience. But in order to get those countries to actually meet the pledge, and it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough for even half of the alliance to meet that pledge 10 years from now. You're going to have leadership and unity and solidarity within the alliance. That's where the American president has enormous power to shape the future.
Well, Mike Carpenter and Hanno Pevko, thank you very much for coming. And to all of you out there who've been watching and listening to this special episode from the Warsaw Security Forum, don't worry, next week we'll be back from Berlin again. But thank you very much. Share your comments with us, and also make sure that you subscribe to our newsletter that comes out once a week, DW Berlin Briefing.